begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello. Bonjour. Zdravstvuyte. That's how you say it. No,
right.
That's not right. Sorry, Russians. I'm your host, one lowly dot on the pavement, Lady P. No relation to Master P. And joining me today is my fellow grad student, recently designated Master of Cinema Studies, Miss Erica Moulton.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, of course. So, Erica, you have a very special interest in today's topic because one, it involves Orson Welles.
Yes.
And that is...
always a draw.
Always a draw. But then you also lived in London for a time, did you not?
I did, yeah.
Okay, so awesome. So that means I will, at some point in today's show, need to hear your Trevor Howard impression.
Oh, gosh. I'll do my best.
Okay. Speaking of Orson Welles, today's very special guest has penned not one, not two, but three books on Mr. Welles. Do you have a Welles impression, anyone? We'll get to that. Making his glorious return to FlixWise is film historian, screenwriter, teacher, and all-American scribbler, Professor Joseph McBride. Welcome back to FlixWise, Joe.
Hi, it's great to be back, as always. Always fun to talk about Welles, too.
Of course, of course. Do you have a Welles impression?
Well, I can kind of do a little bit.
All right. There will be, I'm pretty sure there will be a point in today's episode where, like, we'll all take turns. Okay, so FlixWise has been on hiatus for a little bit, but I am very, very excited that we are finally back on sight and sound duty. You might have guessed, based on the two Welles experts that I have on hand, that that we're doing an Orson Welles movie. Well, if that was your guess, then you were wrong, because today's film is actually directed by British filmmaker Carol Reed. That said, Welles does make a rather memorable appearance. I am, of course, referring to Welles' turn as Harry Lime in the 1949 thriller The Third Man. We are going to talk Welles, as well as Cotton, and also Graham Greene, who wrote the original novella and the screenplay. And then we'll talk about Third Man's place in the film history canon. And then just for a little bonus segment, we're going to talk to Joe about some of his latest projects, including more Welles talk with the latest from the cutting room of The Other Side of the Wind, as well as his book on Ernst Lubitsch, which I'm very excited about. So without further ado, should we get started?
Yes, let's.
Let's do it. All right, cue the zither music. For today's Sight and Sound entry, we have Carol Reed's 1949 international thriller, The Third Man. The plot of the film is as convoluted and meandering as any decent detective story of the era, but here's a real quick synopsis in case you haven't seen it for a while. The film takes place in a shell of a city once known as Vienna, shortly after World War II. The area has been divided into four sections: the British sector, the American sector, the French sector, and the Russian sector. This contentious alliance between the four powers has done nothing but create political and bureaucratic chaos. This chaos, combined with a scarcity of resources, makes the perfect breeding ground for enterprising criminals to develop alternative revenue streams. And into this hotbed of nefarious activity steps one, Holly Martins, played by Joseph Cotton. Holly is an American writer who earns a meager living punching out dime novels about cowboys in the Old West. He's been summoned to the British sector of Vienna at the behest of his old friend Harry Lime, who's promised to cut Holly in on some mysterious new business scheme. However, when Holly arrives in Vienna, Harry is nowhere to be found. Turns out that just hours before Holly got off the train, Harry had been hit by a truck and was killed. Instantaneously? Well, actually, there's some confusion about that point, and with a lot of other points about how and when Lime died. Confusion that Holly plans to clear up before returning back home to the U.S. During the course of Holly's investigation, he meets with a myriad of shady characters, most of whom are Lime's various local acquaintances, including his girlfriend, Anna Schmidt, played by Italian actress Lita Valli. Holly goes around and talks with Lime's business partners, several of whom were supposedly there when Lime was killed. Each of them offer a different, often conflicting account of the events that occurred just before Lime died. They claim that it was only two men who carried Lime out of the street after he was hit by the truck. However, Holly finds another bystander who claims that there was a third man there helping to lug the body out of the street. But who is this third man, and why has he suddenly hightailed it out of Vienna? Well, that's what Holly's looking to find out. That is, if the bobbies don't give him the boot before he can find answers. How's that for some noir talk? I like it. From the moment Holly stepped foot in Vienna, Major Calloway of the British police force has been after him, trying to coerce him into leaving Europe altogether. Calloway, who's played by Trevor Howard, thinks that Lime was up to no good, that he had some shady black market dealings that may even involve murder. He advises that Holly stay far, far away, lest he find himself picking up where Lime left off. Of course, Holly refuses to listen to the police, in part because he believes they had it out for his beloved friend, and he's also starting to develop a thing for Lime's girlfriend, Anna, who's in danger of being deported to the dreaded Russian sector. In the end, we learn that Holly and Anna's devotion to Lime was misplaced. In a twist, it is revealed that Lime was never dead and was himself the third man. Turns out that he faked his own death to cover up the murder of one of his associates and throw the police off the trail of his racketeering plans, which involve him selling diluted penicillin on the black market. In other words, he murdered people with poison vaccines, and he left his girlfriend and his best friend to twist in the wind as they try to put their lives back together. The conclusion of the film involves a virtuosic chase sequence in which Holly and the police hunt Lime down in the sewers of the city until finally Holly corners him and has to decide whether loyalty to his friend overrides his sense of morality and common decency. Well, the plot of The Third Man is certainly as winding and unpredictable as any good film noir. There are a number of ways in which the movie complicates standard noir tropes. In today's discussion, we'll talk about the ways in which Reed's version of the hard-boiled detective genre differs from the American model. And while we're at it, we'll talk about whether The Third Man is worthy of the 73rd spot on the Sight and Sound list. 73.
Seems awfully low.
It does, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I guess we know where you stand. Erica, do you want to start us off? Do you like The Third Man?
I love The Third Man.
Sure, yeah.
It's just completely exhilarated every time I watch it.
Mm-hmm. It's a solid, solid movie. That's the thing about The Third Man. It's just a good time for a movie about a mass murderer, a little bit.
A pretty terrible person.
Pretty terrible person, yeah. Joe, how about you?
Yeah, I think it's a masterpiece. Every time I watch it, I'm just stunned at how dense and complex and beautifully made it is. The cinematography is fantastic, and the writing is amazing. Graham Greene's one of my favorite writers. He's probably my favorite modern novelist, I'd say, and Carol Reed is a superb director, and you know, Wells sometimes falsely gets credit for directing. He had nothing to do with directing the film, and very little to do with the writing. He wrote one famous little speech about the cuckoo clock,
right? Sure.
Which is actually an old joke that he put into the script, and then he ad-libbed a few lines about his indigestion in the Ferris wheel, and that was it. He was only on the film for about 10 days, but he makes such a big impression because people keep talking about him all the way up to the point. I did a book on Wells as an actor. It's the only book on Wells as an actor. So I had to watch all the films that he acted in, which was quite a chore because some of them are really, really terrible. he wouldn't compromise as a director. But he would do almost anything as an actor, you know, to make money for his films. And unfortunately, most people see him just as an actor and they don't see the films he directed. So they look at some awful films. But I had to actually sit and watch these things. And one thing I did was keep track for the reader of when he shows up so you can tune in late if you want to.
But yeah.
You shouldn't tune in late. But he turns up 59 minutes into the film, which is a long time. There's a wonderful quote, if I could read you, where Wells was asked about that. And Peter Bogdanovich says, you have the smallest part, but it dominates one's whole memory of the film. And Wells said, well, that's the part, you know. Every sentence in the whole script is about Harry Lime. Nobody talks about anything else for 10 reels. And then there's that shot in the doorway. What a star entrance that was. In theater, you know, the old star actors never like to come on until the end of the first act. Mr. Wu is a classic example. I've played it once myself. All the other actors boil around the stage for about an hour, shrieking, what will happen when Mr. Wu arrives? What is he like as Mr. Wu? and so on. Finally, a great gong is beaten, and slowly over a Chinese bridge comes Mr. Wu himself in full Mandarin robes. Peach Blossom, or whatever her name is, falls on her face, and a lot of coolies yell, "Mr. Wu!" The curtain comes down, the audience goes wild, and everybody says, "Isn't that guy playing Mr. Wu a great actor?" That's a star part for you. What matters in that kind of role is not how many lines you have, but how few. What counts is how much the other characters talk about you. Such a vehicle really is the thing. All you have to do is ride. So the actors who pick a role counting their lines, you know, are wrong, because as Wells points out, it's, you know, your centrality to the story, and he really is central to it, even though he's only in it for a few minutes, actually.
Sure, yeah. Okay, well, so let me just step through this really quickly. So when did you first see the film, and what was your initial impression? And then has your impression changed?
Back in my Madison days, I was getting interested in Wells. I first saw Citizen Kane in a film class in 1966, and that really changed my life. I was going to be a novelist and a journalist, and I switched over to wanting to write about films and make films. And so then I started looking for a book on Wells's films, and I couldn't find much. So I thought I will write one. And, you know, Madison was a great place in those days for film societies, and at the Union there were a lot of good films. So I managed to see a lot of his films, you know, and I also ran the Wisconsin Film Society so I could bring the films. We had to be more enterprising then because you didn't have home video. So somewhere in there I saw The Third Man and was very impressed. And I was more focused on the films he directed, and wrote my first book on him, which took 4 years. But I was, you know, seeing as many of the films I could that he acted in. This is certainly probably his best film performance other than his own films. In his own films, Chimes of Midnight, where he plays Falstaff, is probably his greatest performance. And of course, he's wonderful in Citizen Kane and Touch of Evil and some other ones. But Harry Lime is the one the public probably knows him the most in, aside from maybe Kane. But for example, when he was in Europe in the 50s, where he was living, every time he walked into a nightclub or a restaurant, the orchestra would strike up the Third Man theme. It became a really big hit recording. Anton Karas was this obscure zither player, and Carol Reed had heard him at a party and had this inspiration to use the music as background. Then the more he heard of it, he thought, well, why do we need an orchestra? Let's just use this guy playing the zither. And it was wonderful. Howard Hawks once told me he thought that was the best score of any motion picture he ever saw or heard. And it was just wonderful.
Wait, who said that?
Howard Hawks told me.
Howard Hawks said that. All right. I mean, he would know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. The Third Man is one of the few Wells appearances where he doesn't have, at least of this era, where he doesn't have any makeup, right? I remember in the Bogdanovich book, he talks about how he always used to disguise his face.
Yeah, that's interesting. He was obsessed with false noses, and he didn't like his nose. He had kind of a small nose for, you know, the size of his body and the large, you know, facial features, and he had like a kind of boyish little snub nose, and he was embarrassed by it. So, you know, he was kind of overly obsessed with that, and so he would carry around a makeup box, and he'd always put on these phony noses, and they were sometimes very bizarre. I remember a Chabrol film, 10 Days Wonder, the nose keeps changing color throughout the Chabrol, I said, you know, why does it do that? And he said it worried me too, because, you know, I noticed that, and I asked Orson about it, and he said, "My dear Claude, I am a changing character."
Oh my goodness.
I imagine that has a lot to do with his stage training as well. I mean, I think he's clearly comfortable, you know, in that mode. Mm-hmm. I think it was on Chimes at Midnight that he used his makeup as an excuse to postpone the actual filming. It was Jean Moreau said, you know, he kept on saying, "Oh, my makeup hasn't arrived yet," you know, and she found his makeup box like hidden in his trailer somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is he was kind of insecure about his acting, and he acted his whole life, which is peculiar. A lot of actors are very shy. He certainly was not a shy person, but he was actors. I mean, I remember when I was young, I saw Henry Fonda on TV, and he said he became an actor because he didn't like being himself and he liked being other people. And that's probably true of a lot of actors. But so Wells, I guess he never also felt that he was as good an actor as he wished he was. And I kind of agree. I think he's got some great talents, but within a certain range, you know, he didn't have, he couldn't do certain kinds of parts. He said he was a king actor. He said in the theater, there used to be actors who played kings, and because of his physique and his voice, he had to play men of power and kings. But Truffaut said that the secret of Wells's films is he always shows the fragility behind the monster and the vulnerability behind the tyrant.
That's particularly interesting for this film. I mean, because in a way, I think what's really remarkable at this performance is that he's so unassuming in some ways. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't really get the sense of the capacity for this character's evil from his performance per se.
Right.
I don't know, we can debate that later, but that was, this time watching it, what I was struck by was you don't really get, for me at least, you don't really get the final sort of, you know, turn of the knife until you go to the hospital ward at the end, and then you realize the capacity that this character has for evil, and it just kind of washes over you.
Absolutely, yeah.
Hannah Arendt called the banality of evil, isn't it? You know, post-war realization that ordinary people did monstrous things during the war, and Harry Lime is kind of a excrescence of that kind of society. But he underplays the menace, it's true, and he's charming. And
very charming.
He has that surface charm that makes people like him. Hitchcock said the best, when you're casting a killer, especially a mass killer, you need a charming actor like Joseph Cotten in Shadow of a Doubt.
Of course, yeah.
He said, how is a person going to kill a lot of people unless you can get close to them? It's an interesting point.
Yeah.
Harry Lime has this kind of good fellow quality, and he's low key. He's not your menacing, cliched villain, which is great because, you know, it's always good to work against the cliche. But the other thing about Harry Lime, it's the only time, there may be one other film, I forget which, but Wells is not wearing makeup in this film. And that's very interesting because he said Harry Lime was the character he hated most of all the characters he played. He said he's Lucifer, the fallen angel. And so he's playing him as himself in a naked way, you know, without a fake nose and with his own face. And that's kind of telling in terms of the guilt themes that pervade Wells' work, you know, that I'm going to play this horrible monster and
do it as myself,
show up, you know. Yeah. Don't wear anything special or wear any makeup. I'll just do it, you know?
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, you mentioned Joseph Cotten, which provides the perfect transition because Joseph Cotten is actually the star of this film, right? So maybe we can talk a little bit about what Joseph Cotten's, just generally about the role of Holly Martins and what we make of him as this kind of, he's not exactly a hard-boiled detective type. Like, this isn't, and we'll get into whether or not we think this is a film noir, whether we'd categorize it as a film noir. But, I mean, maybe you can speak to the historical stuff about their, Joseph Cotten and Orson Welles' friendship, and their frequent collaborations, and generally where they both were in their careers at this point. And how that might play into the dynamic between the two characters, right? So we have Holly Martin, who's devoted to
Harry Lime,
who is Orson Welles. And as you say, like, there is this kind of parallel between the Holly Martin's Lime relationship and possibly between Citizen Kane and Jed Leland, right? So this dynamic plays out a couple times in their career, right?
Well, you know, one reason it seems like a Wells film, and he certainly could have made this film, is it fits his themes, because the basic premise of most of Wells' films is two men love each other and one betrays the other. That happens over and over again, and this is what happens in this film. Holly betrays Harry, and you could argue that Harry betrayed Holly because he wasn't the man he thought he was. And you could make the same argument about Leland and Kane, and Wells and Bogdanovich had an argument that Bogdanovich thought Leland betrayed Kane by writing the bad review, and Wells said, no, Kane betrayed Leland because Kane had led him along and let him down. And Wells always hated people who betrayed their friends. He thought that was the worst thing you could do And he was asked, do you approve of Holly Martin's turning in Harry? And he said, no, of course not. You know, I mean, he was a horrible guy, but you don't betray your friends. And Graham Greene felt very strongly about that. That was a big theme of his. And it came out later that Harry Lime had a lot to do with Kim Philby, the spy, who was a British traitor who went over to the Soviet Union. He was a friend of Greene's, worked with him in the war, and Greene never gave up his friendship with him, and kind of stuck to him despite Philby betraying his country. And Philby's real name was Harry Kim Philby, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Oddly enough, a few things. It didn't start out as being a Wells Cotton casting. Carol Reed wanted James Stewart to play Holly Martin.
I could so see it.
Yeah. That would actually be, yeah, that would work in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Noel Coward to play Harry Lime.
Hmm. Oh, that I could see. He could do Wells has a certain kind of Midwestern charm about him, but he's not like debonair. I don't know. Or there's something, he's not suave, I would say. Like, he has a little glint in his eye. There's something mischievous about him. But he's very boyish. Whereas Coward, I don't know. Like, there's something about, like, maybe you look at him and you think, like, yeah, that guy's up to no good. I don't know.
Well, it is interesting that the two of them are ostensibly Americans.
Mm-hmm. Right, mean, yeah.
Which so it why really would changes the dynamic of, you know, particularly the relationship between the British police and Martins and Lime.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. So what was the thinking behind?
Well, wasn't it Selznick who brought the two of them?
Selznick had the contracts of Cotton and Alida Valley, and so they had to deal with. Selznick made a lot of money by putting people under contract, like Ingrid Bergman was another one, and he was trying to make Alida Valley into a new Ingrid Bergman or a new Greta Garbo, and so he would then loan them out to other companies and make a lot of money off them. And so Alexander Korda, who is a good friend of Wells, who produced The Third Man, who was an amazing character himself, a Hungarian in England and Hollywood, and made a lot of important films. And he was also a spy for the British in World War II, and he really knew his way around the world, a very sophisticated man. And so he had to make a deal with Selznick, which caused a lot of friction. Selznick, you know, was interfering with them to some extent and was trying to dictate some terms. And then when the film came out, it was a big hit in England, and Selznick made some changes for the American market to make Holly a more appealing character. Holly is not a very, he's likable in a sense. Joseph Cotton's a very likable actor, and Holly is a sort of naive, innocent guy. But as Graham Greene writes in The Quiet American, innocence is a form of insanity. I always love that line. Greene was very anti-American, and you get that sense with Holly Martin's that he's, Greene is satirizing and criticizing the American naivete toward the world, our insularity and our lack of sophistication, and our you know, blinkered view, not recognizing evil when we should know it. And so he blunders through Vienna, and Trevor Howard, as the British police commander, is quite, you know, condescending toward him. And Holly drinks too much, and he's a hack writer, and yet he has some things in common with Graham Greene too. And so it's kind of a mixed portrait. But when you have Cotton and Wells together, there's that whole inescapable dynamic from Kane and also the Magnificent Ambersons, where Cotton starred and then Wells. Sure. They went back to the theater, of course. Cotton was a member of the Mercury Theater. That's where he got his start. And Too Much Johnson has turned up recently. Cotton stars, and you can watch it online, and it's a wonderful silent film. Accompaniment to a play that Wells was going to direct, and then the play fell apart, but the film miraculously survives and Cotton, it's his first film appearance. And because of that play, Katharine Hepburn saw him and recruited him to be in the Philadelphia Story with her on the stage. And he didn't get the part for the film, but that made his career, and he became a big star in Hollywood. And so he's a very charming guy, but, you know, the friendship and dynamic between them really is important. And I think Carol Reed, you know, was obviously influenced by Wells. But I was thinking, watching this film, people always say, well, it's so Wells influenced. But I think it also influenced Wells in turn, because if you look at Mr. Arcadin, which was a film he made, you know, in the mid-50s, early 50s, it's actually based on a script Welles wrote for the Harry Lime radio show, which was a spinoff of the movie. The movie was so successful that they did a show called The Lives of Harry Lime, and Welles starred in it and wrote some of the scripts. And for that one, they, you know, it's funny, the public loves villains in movies, but they kind of look the other way at what an awful guy Harry Lime was. And so in the radio show, he's just a charming rogue. He doesn't do anything really bad. You know, he's kind of a on the edges of criminality, but he doesn't do anything like in the film with the penicillin. And Welles wrote a script called Man of Mystery, which was he adapted into Mr. Arcadin. And the kind of vertiginous mood of the film of Mr. Arcadin, where it's jumping from, you know, country to country, and it's kind of a dizzying melange of scenes. That's kind of the feeling you get in The Third Man, too. And part of that is Welles going to Europe. You know, after being an American filmmaker, he left because of the blacklist, really. He left in by early November 1947. He was in Italy, and he lived in Italy for 6 years. And it was late October 47 when the HUAC hearings started in Hollywood. And Welles was not a communist, but he had all kinds of left-wing connections. And so he saw the handwriting on the wall. And actually, Selznick really didn't want to cast him in The Third Man because of his political aura that he had around him, and tried to persuade Korda and Reed not to cast Welles, except he thought it would hurt the box office in the United States. And actually, then the Cuckoo Clock speech, Selznick was worried that in Europe this would be seen as communistic. And he said, well, certainly when it plays Switzerland, we'll have to cut that speech, you know. And so there was this, Welles was in a bad light in America at the time, which is, you know, indicative of how paranoid the whole atmosphere was. And it captures that post-war period of moral confusion and chaos that became very much a part of the Welles universe. It's not that it wasn't there before, but it's accentuated in his European films.
Sure, yeah. And speaking of post-war paranoia, this is frequently categorized as a film noir. It makes sense. It's a sort of thriller mystery where we have this sort of anti-hero at the center, and it's like the location plays a very central role in the development of the story. And yet there's some, I'd say, pretty significant ways in which it kind of diverges from standard noir structure. We can talk about this, but it doesn't have a femme fatale per se, right? So, sort of, yeah. We can talk sort of, yeah. Right. She's the would be femme fatale, but does she play? And in what ways does she play that role? And like, the film noir, as it's normally perceived, or as it's normally, the story goes that, like, it's kind of a manifestation of post-war masculinist paranoia about the kind of the changing roles, dynamics within society, blah, blah, blah. And so much of that is centered around the kind of role of women. And so
that's one reason I'm not a fan of film noir, because I think it's misogynistic. I'm always surprised that it's so popular today, and yet misogyny is supposed to be frowned upon, and yet people just worship film noir. You know, it may be kind of, you know, subconscious reflection of that, but the women are often villains in those films, and I mean, some of them are memorable, like Double Indemnity with Barbara Stanwyck, but Alida Valli is certainly, I'd say, a fairly admirable character in The Third Man. She's very strong, and she's a survivor, and she doesn't turn in Harry. She tries to protect him. I mean, she's not fickle too. I mean, she still loves him despite everything. And it certainly doesn't have that femme fatale quality, in my opinion.
It's interesting that you see her not turning her loyalty to Harry as a virtue.
It is. She has a really interesting position in the film, in that she is not particularly, she's not positioned as a figure of absolute moral good. You know, it's not the kind of, you know, either all good or all bad. I mean, she sort of straddles this line because she is loyal to him. However, he has done truly awful things mm-hmm. that she knows about, sort of knows about. I mean, she's informed sort of what he's done. Loyalty is one of those kind of shifting virtues. Like, it is a virtue, but, I don't know. Once I go to that hospital ward and you don't hear the babies cry, I mean, that is one of those truly chilling moments of silence in film. Mm-hmm. After that, I can't imagine anyone, you know, protecting Harry Lyme.
Yeah.
Does play with your feelings, your morality, which is what a good work of art does, I think, is it complicates things.
Absolutely.
And, Graham Greene wrote a great novel. I'm blanking on one of his last novels, was all about this theme, and it was based kind of on the A.M. Forrester comment that if I had to choose between betraying my friend and betraying my country, I would betray my country.
Okay.
And as I mentioned, Green didn't betray Kim Philby, and he may have had some compromising involvement with him. But Green was a complicated man. He was a member of British intelligence, and his books are amazing because they seem to be ahead of the curve in predicting where trouble is going to break out. And somebody asked him once how he knew about that, and he said, "Well, I always read every headline in the New York Times every day, and then if the headline is interesting, I'll read the story." But he read all the little headlines, you know, from all over the world. But that doesn't actually account for why he turns up in Vietnam and before the war gets, the Americans really were getting deeply involved. He was tipped off by intelligence services that he was still part of, you know, and it goes to Haiti in the 60s and Panama and all kinds of places, hot spots in the world, Africa, and always seemed to be aware of all the dark things that were going on behind the scenes. And the third man, he got some input from a British intelligence officer, and he had some contacts, as I mentioned, not only Philby, but another guy named Smallman, who was a Czech. And so he was getting inside info, but he really believed in not betraying your friends. And obviously when your friend does heinous things, it creates a complicated situation. And I think our loyalties as viewers are torn when Harry is shot by Joseph Cotton. It's portrayed as mercy killing. Harry is shot and he's dying and he kind of nods like, "Kill me," you know. Mm-hmm. It's tragic. It's not a simple or happy conclusion, but it's not. But with her, I mean, there's something admirable about her not betraying the man she loves, even though he's the monster. You know?
Yeah. Maybe. Let's talk about Vienna and sort of how the film utilizes codes of documentary filmmaking to kind of create a sense of, I'll put it to you. Why utilize all this kind of documentary footage or pseudo documentary footage? What is the effect that has on the narrative in the course of the film? I don't know. What do you think that's doing there?
I was just going to say the book by Green that I forgot was The Human Factor. It's a great book. One of his last books.
Gotcha.
Terrific book. I think the atmosphere, and this is a real argument for filming on location, and a lot of films in those days, you know, this was a new thing, most ran to film on location. In Hollywood, they started going on location after the war. It was partly influenced by Italian neorealism, which because of a sort of rebellion against what they called the white telephone films before the war, the studio-bound Italian films, and also the kind of they didn't have much money after the war, so they were shooting on the streets. And so films like Open City and Shoeshine, Bicycle Thief, really had a big impact on world cinema. And there's also a genre that developed after the war, a subgenre, you could call it, called the rubble film, film shot in the rubble of Europe. And you could put in there Germany Year Zero by Rossellini, which is a great film taking place in Berlin, Billy Wilder's A Foreign Affair, and other films, and this one certainly is the rubble of old Vienna with, as it said drolly at the beginning, the film bombed about a bit.
Yeah.
Just You couldn't create that in the studio. Well, actually, you know, when I say you couldn't create it in the studio, a lot of it was shot in the studio, strangely enough. Vincent Korda was the art director, and they shot as much as they could in Vienna. It was the winter. It was cold. They were worried about the snow coming in. And Wells, they brought him down into the sewers, and they explained that they wanted the sewer water to come pouring over his head, and he threw a fit.
Yeah. That doesn't seem
sanitary.
And he
wisely said, no, thank you.
Yeah. You want to do what?
He walked off and said, I'm not going to do this. So they had to, then Carol Reed just calmly said, okay, we'll build the sewers in Shepperton Studios in London. So they actually built a lot of the sewers there, but they had a sewer unit. They had three units going, sewer unit, night unit, and day unit. And Carol Reed was directing all three. He was on Benzedrine 21 hours a day.
Yes.
And, but they recreated a lot of the scenes. Of course, the interiors of buildings and things they would shoot in the studio, but even parts of the cemetery and the streets and the scene where the cat finds Harry in the street, they built the doorway there after shooting kind of the wider shots in Vienna. And Wells did his sewer things inside the studio where they built parts of the sewers, you know, with walkways and ladders and stuff like that. But there are a few establishing shots that really show this extraordinary underground location. But you can't rival the way this beautiful old city looked, partly ruined. And then all the extras, too. It's very important. There are a lot of memorable faces of people in small characters. Some were not actors at all. They just found them on the streets, like the man who sells the balloons and that little boy who...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Was a murderer. He was one of the crew members' sons.
Are those direct callbacks to M?
Yeah, there's a lot of M influence too, isn't there? Yeah, and M has a very street feel too. Mm. That was made right before Hitler took over in Germany. And that influenced thrillers. I mean, film noir and all those post-war thrillers were deeply influenced by German expressionism.
Yeah. I found myself thinking a lot about Lang, though, actually, while I was watching it this time, in terms of, sort of the atmosphere that they create, and obviously with the, you know, Austrian-German settings. And as a city film as well, it's this really fascinating record. I think probably the thing that's said most about the cinematography in the film is, you know, the streets constantly being wetted down, so Robert Krasker could really get that, you know, amazing kind of shine. You really get a sense of the city. And for me, the most thrilling part, you know, is Vienna with those underground tunnels. I mean, the great reveal with Trevor Howard when, you know, they're chasing after Harry Lime and they open the door to go down to the tunnels for the first time.
More.
And you realize, that he was, in fact, there and that he has now escaped back to the sewers from whence he came.
Mm-hmm. And what a, like... I mean, it's there's obviously practical consideration, but what a great metaphor!
It's very metaphorical, isn't it? The slime that goes underneath the respectable facade of the city and people's outward respectability and the ugliness underneath it all. You know, and it's very Graham Greenish. I mean, he loves rot and decay and finds it wherever he goes in his books. You know.
Yeah, I mean, some of the settings. Actually, one that really struck me this time was when you go to Anna's apartment, and it's this really beautiful, ornate apartment, but then you see, like, the walls have started to crumble off, like, all the kind of, you know, molding, everything is kind of falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another great sort of, like, visual metaphor for what the city is undergoing.
Yeah, there's a lot of that kind of old world juxtaposed with the kind of rot, the decay that you were talking about, Joe. I mean,
the destruction
of the world. Theater, it's all they're kind of doing. I don't even know, I'm not sure what that play was. It's obviously a comedy, she only does comedies. But they're kind of trying, there's just kind of, it's like this nostalgic play that's kind of recreating. I don't know if they're like Habsburgs or what's going on, but it's clearly some kind of old world aristocracy. And it's in the middle of this bombed out city, right? Like people are just going to remember the past, I guess, or to have a laugh. A lot of really interesting political context, a lot of political subtext, and a lot of the films of this era have been written about as like, you know, like there have been a lot of zeitgeist arguments and a lot of, a lot of papers have been written about what film noir means and why this time period. And I think I'm often skeptical of these kind of lines of thinking. However, I do think that this film really invites that particular critical lens. I don't know. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think it captures the post-war era as well as any film, the immediate post-war chaos and confusion where people were starving and they were resorting to criminality to survive, and also the strange blend of, you know, destruction of these great cities and yet some of the beauty of the old buildings and cities still remains. Even in Berlin, there were some buildings that survived, and Vienna, a lot of it survived. You could see these tremendous old world buildings. And as you said, play, it's actually not a real play. They wrote that scene film, but it evokes that Habsburg pre-war operetta or light comedy kind of entertainment, and the beautiful opera house, which could have been, you know, from the 1910s.
Right.
And people were used to seeing Viennese operettas and the Merry Widow and all kinds of delightful plays and films that were taking place in the days of the Great Empire before World War I. Of course, everything kind of collapsed after that point. And the 20s was a period of chaos in Europe as well. And then Nazism came in. And Vienna was a country that caved into Hitler very quickly. And Billy Wilder had lived in Vienna before Berlin, and he thought Vienna was more anti-Semitic than Berlin was. And he was in Berlin right before Hitler took over, and he thought Vienna was a terribly anti-Semitic place. And so the Anschluss, they eagerly embraced Hitler, and so there was a real sense of moral collapse that went on after the war, during the war, and after the war, and the world was coming to terms with that. So I think that it's a time capsule. That's one reason I like movies, is they're time capsules. You can go back in time. And when people say, oh, something is dated or something, I think that's so strange, because I like that. That's what's good about films. To capture a certain moment in time and a place, you know, that, of course, you know, the Marshall Plan and everything helped rebuild Europe, but it captures this feeling of in a stage of transition and for the human corruption that thrives on that kind of chaos.
Well, and it's also really interesting because, it's kind of capturing it as a snapshot of a really first, like, global city. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's with the, you know, the opening speech as well. I mean, you get that from the very beginning. This is a city that's divided into these four sections, and the four presences there were not there before, but now this is, you know, this city where all of these cultures are butting up against each other. And it's very funny in the scene where, you know, Holly Martins goes to the performance, because of course he doesn't understand German, and you know there's a funny exchange between him and Valley where she asks him if he speaks German. Of course he has no idea what's going on the entire time, and he sort of says, oh yeah, I could follow it. But yeah, I mean, it's that sense of confusion, you know, these people are all having to talk to each other and interact with each other, but they don't often understand what they're saying to each other, and that's where a lot of these, you know, sort of breakdowns in communications stem from.
Mm-hmm. A lot of untranslated German.
Oh yeah, that's actually a really good point. Yeah, this was made for presumably a British and American audience, and yet there are no subtitles. I noticed that a lot.
The porter. I mean,
yeah, the porter. Yeah, Anna's landlady. Mm-hmm. No subtitles.
Gotten that, you know, he says Americans are notoriously xenophobic and ignorant of other countries, and so it makes you feel like you're blundering around in this.
Right along with him, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And those two actors you mentioned were two of the most famous Viennese actors. Paul Horbiger, the porter, was one of their great actors, and he's playing a porter. And actually, he got top billing when the film played in Vienna.
Yeah.
And he didn't understand English at all, and he had to learn the lines phonetically because he had some things in English. And the landlady was another illustrious actress. And but they were reduced to these smallish parts where they didn't get paid very much too, and but it does create that feeling of foreignness, and predictably Selznick, that's one of the things that bothered him. He seemed like, as his son Danny said, in that period he could easily be mistaken for a caricature of himself. He was not as good as he was when he produced Gone with the Wind. He was kind of getting kind of megalomaniacal and self-important. Graham Greene told some funny stories that made Greene look Selznick look really bad. Like he said that he and Reed went to visit him in Hollywood, and at one point he said, "You know, I just don't understand why you have this buggery in the film, boys." What buggery? They didn't know what he was talking about. And he meant that why would this guy go over to see his friend and not leave and be hung up in his friend? He thought there was something, you know, some buggery going on.
I see. Oh dear. You don't say.
And then another point, he started mentioning some whole plot thing, and they looked at each other and they said, "Well, that's not in the film." And he says, "Oh, Christ, boys, I'm thinking of another film, you know."
Yeah, his eye wasn't on the ball on that one.
Guy, he was busy.
The film, and for the American audience, they took the prologue, which is Carol Reed in a rather dry voice who's playing a petty criminal narrating this documentary footage, setting the scene, and then he doesn't appear again, which is interesting. But Selznick was confused, like, who is this guy? Why is he starting the film? So he changed it to Joseph Cotten narrating to make it a more conventional American kind of thing where the hero is telling you his story. And then they cut out other bits that made Cotten look particularly bad, you know, references to his drinking problems and things like that. But there was no way to make him into a heroic figure, but Selznick was trying in his bumbling way. And I know there are people who prefer the American version, but I much prefer the original British version, which is what you can see at Filmstruck and Criterion now. It would be nice if, actually, the American version has sort of vanished, which is too bad. Although on the Filmstruck side, you can see the opening narration, at least. Which is
right, as a record, yeah. That would be interesting to compare them.
Yeah.
Do you remember if they changed, sort of, does he make any indications in the re-recorded narration about, you know, that he is actually speaking as the character, or did he just re-record the actual narration?
The narration, but with some small changes that were, that it sort of lost the sense of irony that the character had. It seems a little too knowing for the Joseph Cotten character because he's supposed to be this blundering guy who just arrives and knows nothing about Vienna. But the voice you hear at the beginning of the film in the British version is a very sophisticated criminal.
Right.
And but they made some small changes. There's a pretty good book on The Third Man by Charles Drazen called In Search of the Third Man, and he goes into details about all these changes and things. And it's worth reading because he gives you subtle points that where they change the dialogue and reduce some of the texture and the precision of Graham Greene's dialogue, for example.
It's curious that they objected to his drinking. It seems like pretty standard to have this detective ersatz, I guess, but this our investigator, our protagonist, be a hard drinking kind of hard-headed, just every man who has a certain set of moral principles, and they are eventually challenged throughout the course of the film as he gets deeper and deeper into the kind of morass of evil.
I suppose a lot of sort of the hard drinking detectives are sort of coded as veterans, potentially would excuse or explain some of their behavior, whereas he's, I mean, very much, you know, the kind of ugly American.
That's
he's
true.
He's a writer of pulp Western novels.
He's a sloppy drunk who, you know, they push him and he falls down a couple times, and he's, you know, it's not a trait that is admirable in any, even in a tough guy format. And I think the thing with the Western novels and all that, it's supposed to show his childishness, that he's has a boy's view of the world, which is kind of what Greene thought Americans had. And so the Trevor Howard character, who's a very sophisticated British character, is mocking his, he says, you know, I'm not a sheriff and this isn't a Western. And, you know, the good guys and the bad guys are hard to tell apart. And, of course, you know, the best Westerns are not like that, but these pulp Westerns that he's writing were this childish kind of simple morality that is challenged everywhere he looks in Europe. And that's part of the theme of the film. And the ugly American theme is a big one in Greene's work. The Quiet American is a great book. That's the book that takes place in Vietnam. And it's about an American CIA guy who's causing all kinds of havoc. And he's portrayed as this innocent, bumbling guy, but he's very dangerous and sinister. And that's what Greene thought of of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think we've covered most of the things I wanted to touch on, but I'm going to leave it, I'll leave it open to you. Were there any other points you wanted to mention before we wrap up?
Carol Reed, I suppose.
We have not talked about Carol Reed. You are absolutely right.
What a fascinating career he had, yeah.
Yeah, Carol Reed was really first-class director, and especially in that period, he was regarded as one of the world's top directors. He had started as an actor. He was the illegitimate son of Sir Herbert Beerbohm Tree, who was a famous actor-producer. And so Reed was an actor and stage manager and director in his youth, and he had a lot of experience. He worked with Edgar Wallace, the thriller writer, and they were doing plays together. And then he got in the film business and worked his way. The British film industry, you could work your way up from humble things, you know, be an assistant director and become a director. Guy Hamilton was the assistant director on The Third Man. He became a James Bond film director. He directed three of the Bond films. Right. And in America, you can't do that. You don't start as an AD and become a director. It just doesn't happen. But Reed made a lot of superb films. He made, for example, Outcast of the Islands, The True Glory, Odd Man Out, which was a thriller that helped get him the job to do The Third Man. The Fallen Idol is a superb film that Graham Greene wrote. And then his later career was more checkered. He kind of, it seemed like the breakup of the traditional film industry did not serve him well. And he was making films. He worked on Mutiny on the Bounty for a while and got replaced. He did The Agony and the Ecstasy, which wasn't that good. And he did Our Man in Havana, which was another Graham Greene story that he filmed. It was pretty good. And then he won his Oscar for Oliver in 1968, which I haven't seen since it came out. I remember it being pretty good. It's a good.
I liked it a lot as a kid. Yeah, I mean, and I was trying to think back, you know, because I mean, the thing that he's sort of most distinctive, or in this film, is, you know, obviously the Dutch angles. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think we mentioned those yet.
Yeah,
but
we haven't.
I was trying to think if like he used them in Oliver. I think there's maybe like two or three shots where he uses a Dutch angle.
It's fancy, huh?
But yeah, I've actually rewatching Third Man made me feel bad because when I teach production, I show my kids the Battlefield Earth, the, you know, Dutch angles is an example of bad filmmaking. And I say, I mean, I almost feel like I need to apologize to Carol Reed because he uses
all
them
Dutch
so
angles
effectively in this particular film.
It's true. Yeah. I mean, he's clearly working off of the Caligari model, right? You're going directly to the source. Whereas, I don't know, if
maybe
Travolta.
Not yeah. Probably not.
Maybe not.
It's back to German Expressionism and it's world out of whack, and it was very influential. John Ford made The Rising of the Moon. Robert Krasker was the cinematographer who did The Third Man, and they used the tilted angles all through the 1921 sequence about the British and Irish war for independence. And again, the world was out of whack and tilted and everything, and it became. You could easily say it's effective, but it certainly works in The Third Man and in the Ford film, too. But Reed was, Wells paid tribute to him. He said, you know, he had a lot of qualities that he made him feel very comfortable. He understood actors very well, having been an actor. He worked very well with children, for example. It's hard to direct children. He was known for his great patience and subtlety. And non-actors, he worked very well with them. And temperamental actors like somebody like Wells or Trevor Howard, you know, he could handle them. He was a very strong character, but kind of quiet and didn't throw his weight around. But he was very firm, you know, and when people are pressuring him, like just the decision to use the zither music was, you know, so unusual that he had to put up with a lot of pressure not to do that. And he just quietly resisted it. And he insisted on shooting on location, and when he was having trouble, you know, they're trying to get him to hurry up, and he wouldn't do it. And so Wells thought he had all the qualities of a fine director, as well as tremendous respect for the writers, which a lot of directors don't have. And if you're a really smart director, you appreciate the qualities the writer brings to it. And he didn't throw his weight around. He didn't proclaim how he's a great auteur and all that. And that's kind of maybe hurt his reputation. He just made good films, and he made a variety of films. He didn't like to make the same kind of films that he's often compared to Hitchcock. He thought Hitchcock kind of repeated himself too much, and he said, I would be bored if I made the same kind of film over and over. And Billy Wilder said the same thing. I like to do different kinds of things. And when David Lean got his AFI award, he quoted Noel Coward. He said, always come out of a different hole. And Carol Reed kind of did that, and you never quite knew who he was as a result. And that, you know, I think critics and film historians like to easily pigeonhole somebody as, oh, you made that kind of film or this kind of film. And then when they try to make something that's very different, people scold them for it.
Yeah, well, on that note, actually, so speaking of another director who sort of fell, you know, prey to the same problems because he didn't make distinctive films, so Willie Wyler, there is a connection here that I actually had a question for you about whether you knew this was actually true or not, the story about Wyler sending him the balance, you know, to put on his cameras after seeing the film because he had such a problem with all the canted angles. He said he told him to put it on top of his camera next time he directed. I assume that's apocryphal, but maybe you have more intel. Is it true?
At the spirit level that, you know, he sent it to him as a gag.
Right.
And, people were kidding him about that. And but Wyler admired the film a lot. But Wyler is a good comparison. He was a fine craftsman who made all different kinds of films, some better than others. It depended partly on the material and the cast. When he had the right material and the right cast, like in The Heiress, I think is a great film, and The Best Years of Our Lives, you know, he was self-effacing craftsman. And those kinds of directors don't get the publicity or the books written about them as much as they should.
True. Well, I think I'm glad we're here to redeem the legacy of one Carol Reed. And speaking of legacies, this film is the 73rd film on the Sight and Sound Critics Poll. I feel like as we continue going through this list, this question gets more and more ridiculous. But I'm going to ask it anyway. So 73, is that an appropriate spot for The Third Man? And obviously, I can't ask you to pinpoint exactly where you think on the list you think it should fall. But I guess I'll just say, ask you more generally, like, what do you think the legacy of this film should be? Do you think it is as well remembered as it should be? I know that here in Madison, we still teach this film in the intro to film history course. I hope it is well remembered. I hope it is still well liked. But I'll put it to you, Joe. Do you have thoughts?
Well, I think that, you know, as long as it's on the list, it's kind of arbitrary where these things fall on the list. One of the strange things about this film is that the American Film Institute had a list of the greatest American films, and they put this on the list, which I thought was a prime American cultural chauvinism.
That is very true. Did Lawrence of Arabia make the list as well?
Yeah, I think that was
enough. Oh, gosh.
And this, you know, okay, Columbia put the money behind Lawrence, and this one, Selznick, just loaned them the stars for, he got paid for it. But it was foreign money, and it was a British production. It's a British film. It's been picked somewhere as the greatest British film ever made. That's more up. But it certainly is one of the classics, and it is a very popular film. A lot of film goers who are not, don't know Mr. Arkadin or even Touch of Evil might know The Third Man, and there's nothing wrong with that. And it's just a classic. And, you know, the one thing about Carol Reed, I should mention, the famous ending where it's a great shot, and it's been imitated in other films, where Alida Valley just walks past Joseph Cotten, where the cliche ending would be they'd get together and walk off together. It didn't happen. It's a moral judgment. She passes on him, and she just walks past. It's wonderful, long take. In the novel, Graham Greene had them, Cotton pursued her, and they went off together. It's kind of surprising that a writer as dark as Graham Greene would have that kind of sentimental ending. And Carol Reed came up with the idea for the ending as it is. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing a good director can do. It's certainly one of the great classics in every way, shape, and form. And but I'm just glad it's on the list. You know, When I contributed to that list, and it's hard to pick your 10 favorite films, so I just picked like my favorite directors and picked one film by each one. I put two Wells films on the list, Chimes of Midnight and The Magnificent Ambersons, but it's somewhat arbitrary because there's so many great films that, you know, you shouldn't have to rank films ahead.
Sure, yeah. that's fair, yeah. But it's still so much fun.
I was telling you about your podcast. And they said, what is it? And I said, well, she bases it on the Sight and Sound list. And the guy said, what a great idea for a podcast. You know?
Oh. All right. See, people love a good
list. People do love ranking things. Yeah, they really do. Yeah. I mean, if I were to rank it for, I mean, my own personal list, it would probably be quite a bit higher. But, you know, I have a soft spot for British film. And
do you?
As a national cinema, I think it's, you know, one that deserves quite a bit more critical attention. And particularly, I mean, Alexander Korda, I mean, it would be fascinating to do an entire podcast just on the films that he was involved in.
Should we do a podcast on that Hamilton woman?
Oh, that would be fascinating. I mean, but, you know, his involvement, you know, kind of championing directors like Lean, like Powell and Pressburger, like Reed, you know, early works by Olivier. I mean, there's quite a bit more to be said about British cinema, and this is definitely one of the best that it's ever produced.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm. Yeah. For a long time, this was in my top 10. I don't know if I'd still count it among my top 10, but it's certainly one of my all-time favorite movies. I don't know if I can speak to whether 73 is a good spot for it, but as you said, Joe, I'm very glad it's on the list. Yeah. And Erica, you're right. There isn't a lot of other British films that are on the list thus far. I think Lawrence of Arabia is coming up. I think they might be around the same range. But you're right. As a national cinema, it is largely overlooked. So we can write that wrong, though. I believe in us.
I saw Truffaut, who said the words British and cinema are antithetical.
Leave it to Truffaut. That's beautiful. Oh, that's perfect. All right, I feel like we'll end there. Before we sign off, Joe, I did want to give you... I wanted to talk to you about some of your recent projects. I know you've had an opportunity to see a cut of The Other Side of the Wind.
Yep.
What can you tell us?
Well, I saw it four times, and it was an intermediate cut. I'm a consultant on the film, so I'm not supposed to be talking about, you know, the cut. So I won't do that, although I'll say I liked it very much. You know.
Okay. All right. That's good.
Yeah. Two thumbs way, way up.
Two thumbs up. All right. All right. That's good.
Excellent.
Okay. Do you think it's basically holds true to his vision? Do you think?
I think they did a wonderful job of doing that. And it's you know, I mean, there's such riches in that film, things that I hadn't even known about. And I was with that film for the whole shoot, although I wasn't there all the time, but I was on it from beginning to end and read the scripts, of course. But there were things that surprised me that I didn't even know existed. And the texture and the complexity of it was, it's fascinating to see it all come together. And I saw it before they put the music on it and before they did the complete sound mix. So, you know, it's still the final touches are being put on it. So, you know, wait and write about it until after I see it. But we should be able to see it in, I'd say, the late summer, early fall. It was going to be at the Cannes Film Festival, and people probably know there was a dispute between Netflix and Cannes because the French film industry doesn't like Netflix films to be shown at Cannes because they don't play theatrically.
Sure.
So Netflix pulled their films, and so it'll play at some other festival toward the fall, and then it'll be on streaming video around the world. You know, Netflix, I think, is in 150 countries, which is a fantastic audience, the kind of audience Wells never had in his life. I think he'd be thrilled by that.
Yeah. Certainly looking forward to that. And then you have one other exciting project in the works that it's been in the works for quite a long time, perhaps not as long as The Other Side of the Wind, but I know we've been teasing this book for a number of years now, and I'm very, very excited to announce on this show officially that Joe's book on Ernst Lubitsch will be coming, will be published very, very soon. Joe, is there an exact date when people can expect to be able to pick up a copy?
Yeah, June 26th is the official publication date, but the way they always work it is that's the date when, you know, you set it, so it's definitely in all the stores and on Amazon and everything. It'll be reviewed before that or around that time, and it's already getting some terrific reviews in Publishers Weekly and Library Journal, and very gratifying reviews. And by the time this show is played, there'll be more reviews. So anyway, it's very, very good to have it out after 9 years of work. It was a real pleasurable book to write because I started it partly because I just love Lubitsch's films, and they were hard to see for a long time. When I was in Madison, I saw Trouble in Paradise, which got me hooked on him, and I thought, boy, I've just seen this guy's masterpiece. It's such a great film. But I hadn't seen all the other stuff, and now I've seen everything that exists, 47 films that exist in whole or in part of 72 he directed, which is a pretty good survival rate for somebody from that silent period. And Trouble in Paradise, I still think, is his greatest film. It's just a perfect film, and so it's on the cover of the book, and I'm going to be showing it here at a festival, and I'm going to be at the UCLA Lubitsch Retrospective, which starts July 6th. I'm going to do a couple of evenings there, and part of the goal of the book was to get the films visible again so people could just see all these wonderful films, and a lot of them have never been released, like the German films, never released in America. Some of the German films, you know, when I started the book in the early 2000s, a few of them had come out on DVD and videotape, but very few, and more have been coming out, which is good, but some of them have still not made it onto DVD. There are a few you can watch on YouTube, like Cole Hiesel's Daughters is a wonderful film I recommend. It's a delightful sex farce. And I Don't Want to Be a Man, a wonderful cross-dressing film from 1918, way ahead of its time. The Oyster Princess is one of his best films. It's a German film. You can see those on YouTube. A couple of those are out on DVD, but a lot of them aren't. And so some of them I had a hard time going to see. And so I wanted to just have an excuse to see them. And I traveled to Germany twice and Switzerland. We did a complete Lubitsch retrospective at the Locarno Festival in Switzerland that I curated. And then it moved to the Cinémathèque Française. So I got to see really good prints of all the films. And they're restoring now Rosita, which is finished. The Museum of Modern Art is about to show it, and it's going to play in San Francisco. I'm going to sign my book after a screening of that. And then they're working on Forbidden Paradise, which is another delightful American silent film. Actually, the American silent period is one of the least visible. He made some great films in that period, and there aren't too many of them available. But Forbidden Paradise was, for a long time, you could only see it in these terrible bootleg prints from Russia. And so the Museum of Modern Art has collected materials from around the world and trying to make it look as good as it can. It won't be perfect, but Rosita, also Mary Pickford, made it, and then she conceived this insane hatred for the film and tried to destroy it. And again, there were prints in Russia and other places, and they've tried to make that look as good as they can. With the modern technology, you can do a lot with restoration. So somebody said it's the year of Lubitsch, which I hope it is. And that's my goal in writing this. You get people to see the movies and have a good time.
Sure, yeah. And we're going to do what we can because, absolutely. Yeah, I think so. We'll just offer this is just a little tease. I think we're going to do another episode with Joe in the coming months. Hopefully, if we can squeeze in some time, we're going to do a Lubitsch double feature because there are two Lubitsch movies on the Sight and Sound list. So yes. We have a perfect excuse. So
more
stay
Lubitsch
tuned.
All the time.
More Lubitsch all the time. Exactly. And the book is called How Did Lubitsch Do It, right? Which hopefully. Hopefully people know the story about Billy Wilder and the sign he kept above his desk, right?
How would Lubitsch do it? That was his motto, and he said he kept it on his wall so that he would never write one sentence that he would be ashamed to show to his good friend Ernst Lubitsch.
There you go. That's beautiful. Okay. Well, again, we'll keep you posted, listeners, on when you can expect to be able to pick up a copy. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, do you have thoughts on The Third Man? Come share them in the comments section on our website, flickswise.com, or you can come to our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. But wait, there's a third place you can go, to Twitter. The handle is at FlixWise. Coming up on the show, we have some FlixWise favorites entries. I know we're doing Oliver and Company, the misbegotten Disney film. I know, and on Sight and Sound, we have Claire Denis' Beau Travail coming up soon. Solid, solid film. You're going to want to watch that. You might have some trouble finding a copy, but hopefully you can track one down. And I promise if you do, it is worth it. It's such a great film. So stick around for that. Until then, Joe, it has been an honor as always.
Well, it's been fun as always. And thank you, Erica. And thank you, Pauline. It's been great talking about Wells and Third Man and Carol Reed.
Absolutely, absolutely. Erica, I don't think you've gotten away with anything.
Oh, no.
Where's my accent?
Oh, how about this? Cheerio, old chap.
Cheerio, cheerio. All right.
That's the closest you're going to get to Trevor Howard.
I love it. Cheerio, cheerio.